are one massive collective voice. That is what Rose Army is about. It is about all of us being roses in our own life. Not me, the actual flower, because we have thorns. And our thorns carry justice. And our thorns carry consequence. It's time to be whole. It's time to rise. It's time to be brave.
Rose McGowan speaking at the Women's Convention back in October. McGowan says she was raped by Harvey Weinstein in a hotel room at the 1997 Sundance Film Festival. She was one of the first women to speak out against Weinstein. But her story of triumph has now taken a dark turn. Jill Messick was McGowan's manager at the time of the alleged rape. She later went on to work for Miramax, which was founded by the Weinsteins. On Wednesday, Messick took her own life. She had struggled with bipolar disorder and depression for years. But her family says Messick's death was connected to McGowan's statements and to the relentless media scrutiny. All of this adds to the already complicated discussion about the effects of the Me Too movement and the risk of casting judgment on people caught up in a wide net of sexual assault allegations. Matt Bellamy has been covering this story for The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, this is really, such a tragedy. She was just 50 years old. She had two kids. Tell us a little bit more about her and her work.
Well, she was a fairly prominent producer and executive in the industry, and 20 years ago was Rose McGowan's manager. And she was thrust into the spotlight during as a part of the Harvey Weinstein scandal because Rose McGowan had cited her as one of her representatives who had put her in the kind of position that allowed her to be allegedly raped by Harvey Weinstein. And in addition, Harvey himself had cited an email that Messick had sent as justification or as, potentially exculpatory evidence for himself. He put that out there and dragged her into this debate.
Mm. And she or her family had said in this long statement that the Hollywood Reporter published that Messick remembered McGowan as kind of voluntarily getting into a hot tub with Weinstein and then regretting it later. But she had said that it was consensual.
Well, she had also said that she felt bad or she felt that there was some alarm about the incident. So she did report it to her superior. She was junior at the time. So the family's position on this is that she actually did the right thing at the time for someone who was in her position. And yes, she did go on to work at the Weinsteins Miramax, but that was not there was nothing there for Rose McGowan to then attack her 20 years later. And that when she did that, and when Harvey Weinstein then dragged her email into the scandal, it shined a spotlight on someone who was a private person and what they called essentially collateral damage to this scandal.
Mm, okay, I want to read part of the statement. It says, over the past few months, many women have come out with allegations against Harvey Weinstein, including Rose McGowan, who has repeatedly spoken with the press, striking out against not only her alleged attacker, but a great many others. One of them was Jill, who chose to remain silent in the face of Rose's slanderous statements against her for fear of undermining the many individuals who came forward in truth. Now, you spoke with at least one member of the family. Can you tell us more about this statement, the longer statement, and what they're saying?
Yeah, I spoke with a member of the family and friends who put this together, and the anger and the kind of grief-stricken voice in this piece, I think, comes from the fact that they acknowledge that this is a person who had mental illness and had been suffering for years. But this trifecta of what Harvey Weinstein was doing with the email and how Rose McGowan had singled her out as part of the problem when they say that she was a big supporter of the Me Too movement. And frankly, the media's role in all this, both social media and the media outlets that have been reporting on a lot of these allegations and the people involved, that had all come together in a way that was overwhelming for Jill Messick and contributed to her taking her own life.
So when we talk about the media's role, and of course we're part of the media and we've reported a lot on this story, I mean, does this give you pause? Does it make you think, well, gee, we need to maybe look at, do things a little differently?
It's an interesting question because I disagree with a little bit of what's in that statement. And I believe that the media has played an important and crucial role in this Me Too movement, giving voice to a number of women whose stories, frankly, just have not been told and should have been told over the past 2-3 decades. So I don't think that there is a, you know, that the media is quote unquote to blame in this situation. But that said, I think there is a conversation that's going on in the media and within Hollywood about this pendulum and whether that pendulum has swung so far to the other direction where some media outlets have gone over the line in terms of what they have published. And there isn't enough consideration being taken as to the people that are being brought into this scandal who may not necessarily be at fault.
Right. I mean, there was a picture of Messick in the one of the New York Times stories, I think.
Right. And, you know, obviously the media outlets that are responsible in this reporting, they're going to these people for comment, and some are defending themselves and some are saying they're not, you know, I wasn't involved. But this was a person who it seems was not in the kind of mindset to be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, this is all coming out as Rose McGowan is on book tour for her memoir and about this whole situation. And it seems like, oh boy, you know, now are we also in danger of kind of over blaming her for Jill Messick's death or pointing fingers at her when she has gone through quite a bit, according to her own account.
Absolutely. And that's the danger here is that, you know, and I think that this is a very valid point that people say this is a victim here. You know, Rose McGowan is an alleged victim of Harvey Weinstein, and yet she is being called out in this case. And I think people have pointed that out. You know, it's a very, very interesting and complicated subject that people are dealing with here. And I think the challenge is that you don't want to minimize anyone's voice, but you also want to be responsible in how these things are being portrayed. And obviously the family has its own position and they're coming from a particular place, but I don't think anyone is saying Rose McGowan should not have spoken out about what happened to her in her mind 20 years ago.
All right, Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Coming up, in 2015, a British man tried walking alone across Antarctica. He was 55 years old and had zero support.
What food he could carry, he had to haul all that behind him. He would, you know, march for sometimes 16 hours in a day through an unceasing whiteout.
Henry Worsley's incredible trans-Antarctic journey next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In 2015, a retired British Army officer named Henry Worsley attempted something nobody else had ever tried, trekking across Antarctica alone, across an entire continent, up and down glaciers with no help. He pulled his 325-pound sled of provisions by his waist, and sometimes on skis, sometimes by foot, he made his way across more than 900 miles. He was 55 years old. David Gran writes about Henry Worsley's journey in The New Yorker, the current issue. Welcome to the program, David.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you. What an incredible piece. It's a long, long piece. It's almost book length, I will say.
Yeah.
But definitely worth reading because you really get into the details of him and his motivation. He was, Henry Worsley was in the British Army for most of his life, but it seemed like he was more than just an Army guy or a trekker. He had a wide array of interests. He, for instance, taught lace making to prison inmates. Tell us more about who he was.
He was an Army officer and was very successful in that realm, very distinguished. He served as an officer with the SAS, which is like our U.S. Delta Force, the kind of very legendary special forces. But he also had all these other interests. He kept ferrets as pets. When he was stationed in various places in the military abroad, he would stop, for example, in Afghanistan to paint the landscape. He took up lace making when he was first assigned into combat as a way to kind of calm his nerves. And from then on, he would kind of weave tapestries and pillowcases and cushions before grabbing his gun and kind of heading out. I mean, he was, in many ways, modeled himself on and resembled the kind of legendary Edwardian explorers who he had grown up admiring. And most particularly, he modeled himself after Ernest Shackleton.
And Ernest Shackleton is really a British hero. He's almost like a Neil Armstrong figure because he led a couple of polar expeditions in the early 20th century to Antarctica. And so what was it about Shackleton that Worsley so admired?
So the thing that makes Shackleton such an interesting hero is that in many ways he was a failure in that he set out with various objectives on different expeditions. First, to reach the South Pole, which he never achieved, coming within 97 miles. And another time, try to walk across Antarctica, but his ship got frozen in ice, the famous Endurance expedition. Endurance was his ship. It got frozen in ice and he sank. But on both those field expeditions, what set him apart and turned him into a hero in the eyes of so many was he was able to guide very coolly under great danger and duress and get all his men back to safety and get them back alive, often seemingly under impossible circumstances. And so many people over the years, Worsley among them, but many others, from business executives to political strategists, almost in every realm, Shackleton and his management and his guiding of his expeditions have been studied for his methods of leadership.
And what was his method of leadership? What was it that set him apart and made him someone that people want to emulate?
Many polar expeditions, because of the deprivation, because of the claustrophobia, sink into almost a Hobbesian state with members turning on each other, in some cases even mutinying and murdering. And Shackleton would hold these parties together both through preaching his optimism and patience, but he also did things, especially in his day, that were unconventional. He kind of ignored traditional naval hierarchy and made sure to kind of democratize his expeditions in which he treated each man equally. They were given similar rations. They had the same menial chores. He did not set himself apart from that either. He was very acutely aware of kind of the psychology of a group under those circumstances, and what would you need to do to hold them together so that you could stay united and ultimately with the ultimate mission of surviving.
Right. And then he is revered, as you said, for turning back, for not forging ahead and making the goal when it seemed that his men would die if they did.
Yeah. I mean, most famously, in the first expedition he commanded himself, he led a party. It was a four-man party toward the South Pole, and he got within 97 nautical miles of the pole, and he could have reached the pole. He could have been the first to have arrived at the South Pole, which was had been a long simmering dream of his. But to get there, he would have had to deplete food rations, and the three men with him were already fading, and he was concerned that if he did, he would not be able to get all his men back. And he chose to turn back, which Henry Worsley considered, you know, one of the most astonishing decisions in the history of exploration.
So before he embarked on his solo journey, his last journey, Henry Worsley went on a group journey and tried to do what Shackleton couldn't do, reach the South Pole, and he took two men with him. And tell us about that journey briefly and how they were able to overcome the obstacles. Did Worsley, in fact, employ Shackleton's leadership techniques?
Yeah, so Worsley, I should say, was a descendant of Frank Worsley, who was the captain on the famous Endurance expedition. And from when he was very little, just a young boy, he began to read about Shackleton and revered him and always dreamed of doing an expedition. And so finally, in 2008, he launched an expedition to retrace Shackleton's route to the South Pole. He did it with two other men. They were all descendants of members of Shackleton's party. They set out to haul all their supplies and to see if they could both get to the 97-mile mark and then, as they called it, to complete unfinished family business and make it all the way to the South Pole. It's important to understand the environment of the Antarctica because it is unlike any other environment on Earth. They are going across a terrain that is simply and completely inhospitable to human life. There are no animals, there are no creatures. Temperatures, a wind chill factor, you know, can reach as much as minus 100 degrees. They are marching through gale force winds. They are crossing a glacier at one point, which is packed with crevasses. One wrong step, and they will fall through a hidden chasm into the underworld, never to be seen again. And these three men, none of whom have been explorers before, set out on this trek and over kind of remarkable challenges were able to achieve their goals. And Worsley throughout applied the lessons that he had learned from studying Shackleton, preaching patience, optimism, making sure to share in all the menial tasks, participating in each goal, adapting to challenges and difficulties as they found them. And because of that, they succeeded.
I love how one of the men put it later. You quote him as saying, "What is Antarctica other than a blank canvas on which you seek to impose yourself?"
Yeah, a line that really captures what so many explorers have done, because even the points they are trying to reach, they're no more than a geographical data point. They're not uncovering ruins. They're not finding ancient settlements. For example, the 97-mile mark, they looked around when they got there. They were starving. They were hungry. They were weakened. Their faces were frozen. Their beards were then untamed and icicles hung from them. And when they got to this point that it kind of lured them almost to their demise, they looked around. There was nothing there but barren ice. So that quote, that what is it but a blank space to impose yourself on, really captures what that is.
Were you able, through all your reporting on this, able to understand why they did this finally?
For each of them, it was in some ways a test of character to kind of measure themselves. And I think particularly for Worsley, for him, getting closer to Shackleton was always a way of getting closer to himself, kind of understanding who he was. He found the Antarctica a beautiful place, a kind of spiritual place in that alien landscape. But ultimately, I think he found it as a way to test himself.
I just want to play a clip of tape from his solo trek. He would record a message on his satellite phone and when he was calling his friend in England, who would record it and then post it on his website. Here's a clip of him from day 67.
It feels marvelous to be here. It's been a very grueling expedition, grueling journey. The best message for me in my little tent is blowing a bit outside now.
Okay, so he says it's marvelous to be here. It's been a very grueling expedition, a grueling journey. The message is from me in my own tent. It's blowing a bit outside now. That's probably an understatement. And he says it's probably in the minus 30s with wind chill. So when he was doing his solo journey a couple of years ago, he was quite a sensation. People were following his journey from all over.
Yes. You know, he had become a really renowned explorer. During this expedition, his solo expedition, which was about 1,000 miles walking across alone, having to carry all his supplies. He did not have dogs to help pull the sled. He had nobody planting food along the way so he wouldn't starve. What food he could carry, he had to haul all that behind him. He would, you know, march for sometimes 16 hours in a day through an unceasing whiteout, pitch his tent alone in hurricane winds, and then, you know, make these little radio dispatches. And so listeners could follow him. And it really captivated people. A lot of school children followed it. Of course, people asked how he went to the loo in the middle of Antarctica. And he would happily and very funnily describe it. So, and he had always been this deeply captivating figure. I mean, even when he was an army officer, other soldiers and officers admired him the way he admired Shackleton.
So a few days after that dispatch, that was day 67, on day 71, he just can't go on. Can you describe what he was going through physically?
Toward the end of this expedition, he made it to the South Pole, and then he still had about 300 more nautical miles to go to complete the trek. I mean, it was, and nobody, and it's important that nobody had ever done this.
And I just want to pause you right there, because he reaches the South Pole where there is the McMurdo station, where he could have gone inside, had a shower, had a cup of tea, whatever, revived himself. But according to his strict rules, he couldn't do that.
No, because then he would be receiving help, and he was doing this all solo. So he did what he always did, which was to maintain his self-imposed exile, and he pitched his tent away. He couldn't take a bath. He couldn't warm up. He had to do everything on his own. And toward the end of that expedition, he was climbing something around this period called the Titan Dome, which is about 10,000 feet above sea level. And by then, he had lost more than 40 pounds.
And he was still dragging that sled behind him?
Still dragging his sled behind him, which when he started out weighed well over 320 pounds. By that time, still probably weighed, even with the depletion of food, at least 310 pounds. His back is throbbing. He's desperately hungry. His fingers are beginning to suffer from frostbite. His feet are discolored with bruises. He had pushed himself against these obliterating conditions, and he was getting closer and closer to his goal of achieving history, but he was also getting closer and closer to collapse and to the cold consuming him.
And here's a dispatch when he decides he's going to call for help and get airlifted out of there.
My journey is at an end. I have run out of time, physical endurance, and a simple sheer inability to slide one ski in front of the other to cover the distance required to reach my goal. My summit is just out of reach.
He says, my summit is just out of reach. How far was he from his goal?
About 100 nautical miles. The distance was very similar to the distance Shackleton had to the South Pole when he turned back. The truth is, the thing that allowed Shackleton not to go to his polar grave was the acceptance of the limitations of himself and his men, and to realize that there was triumph in defeat, which is life itself. And Worsley made that decision and called for what he referred to as the most expensive taxi ride in the world, which was the call for this airplane to come pick him up. He rose and very proudly on his own volition walked to the plane, although he needed help walking up the steps. And he called his wife when he got to the base camp and said, I'm having a cup of tea, darling, and everything's going to be fine.
Mm. And the question is, what happened to him? I mean, he had such horrible injuries. I guess he had organ failure. Was he dying at the time?
He was not aware, obviously, what was happening totally internally within his body. And when he got to Union Glacier, they had to rush him to a hospital where they discovered he had this perforation. He was rushed into the operating room. He began to go into organ failure, septic shock. Joanna, his wife, was getting updates, and first she heard his kidney failed, and she said, well, you can live without a kidney, can't you? And then she heard that his liver had failed, and she said, you can live without a liver, can't you? And then she was informed before she was able to get to the hospital that he had died. And it really is a great tragedy because Worsley, in many ways, had realized in that critical moment he had understood Shackleton, and he understood the meeting, and he decided to turn back. And then very tragically he died. And one thing that Joanna said that always kind of haunted me, when he had turned back, she said, he chose us.
Mm. Well, she and her and their two children buried his ashes, or scattered his ashes in the South Pole, right?
Yes, they did. And they have a remarkably resilient family. They decided just a little over a month ago to take Worsley's ashes to the island of South Georgia, which is where Shackleton is buried. And it was kind of referred to as the gateway to the Antarctica because it was kind of the last island you would stop at before you would head toward the continent of Antarctica. And they took Henry's ashes there not long ago. They took them in a little box that Henry had made and brought on one of his expeditions. And there they buried it in the earth, overlooking Shackleton's grave.
What an incredible story, David.
You know, you as a reporter, you find stories, but certain stories just really touch you. And this was one of them. And I think partly it was just spending time with his family and getting a sense of Henry and getting a sense of them.
The article is called The White Darkness, A Journey Across Antarctica. It's in the current issue of The New Yorker, and it is very well worth the read. David Gran, staff writer at The New Yorker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And if you want to see photos of Henry Worsley and Ernest Shackleton on their expeditions, you can head over to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, it's time for movie reviews. We'll talk about the final film in the 50 Shades trilogy.
This film is going to get nominated for Razzies, but I think it deserves its own strange Oscar for managing to make something this watchable out of books that are so awful.
Our critics are at odds about that one. We'll review that, plus Clint Eastwood's latest, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Friday, that means it's time for movie reviews. Amy Nicholson is here. She writes for Variety and hosts the podcast The Canon. Hi there.
Hello.
And Whitney Seibold is here, too. He contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. All right, let's start with Clint Eastwood's 1517 to Paris, which stars the real men, real life men, not actors, real life men, who thwarted a terrorist attack on a train in 2015. And here's a clip.
Don't try and take any shortcuts. Do what you know is right. We've been chosen for this great work.
I don't know, man. You ever just feel like life is just pushing us towards something, like some greater purpose?
Okay, Amy, remind us what really happened.
Okay, so this is the incident when a man on a train from Amsterdam to Paris pulled out a gun with 300 clips and was taken down fairly quickly by three American friends who have been buddies since they were in Sacramento. Two of them are military. One of them was just along for the ride to go drink and party in Italy. It's about a minute-long attack, so how do you make a movie out of that? I think you get a hint from that clip that Clint Eastwood is trying to make a film about being touched or blessed or being a screw-up kid from Sacramento who's been anointed to do something terrific. Mm. And, you know, casting the original people who were in this attack as lead actors kind of pays off for Clint Eastwood. I'll be honest about that. I mean, as a preface, I think he's making movies that are now increasingly becoming like my crazy uncle on Facebook posting a meme, but just in movie form.
Well, there was The Empty Chair, let us not forget, at the RNC several years ago.
Exactly. He's on a slope that I'm raising flags about. But the buddies here have a real charisma when they become adults. And you really feel they're not the best actors. They're not the best at having line delivery. But the lead guy has a good charisma. And you get that they're friends, which you need because since there's not really a plot here, I swear to God, and I'm not making this up, 30 minutes of the movie is just them hanging out in Europe with a selfie stick and eating gelato and saying things like, the Trevi Fountain, bro. And it is, it is so inane. It's almost fascinatingly inane that this movie exists. I saw it at midnight. And
how many people were in the theater?
Maybe 10. It was a very strange, almost like a church. We were just there to see what he was going to present to us. I thought they weren't even screening it for critics at all. And then a few came out yesterday. Hmm. I think there were some reviews also out of Europe, maybe. I think that Clint Eastwood knows who his audience is here. You know, there's this habit that's been going on that he almost started with American Sniper. Lone Survivor was the year before that.
Sully, he did.
Sully. There's this kind of Docbuster movie that's based on a true story with really tough men. And those movies do okay because they aim to be telling the truth. It's hard to say what in here might not be the truth. And honestly, it might all be true.
Does it glorify the Air Force or just present these guys as regular fellows?
You know, it leans into the fact that the main character is a bit of a screw up. Like, he goes in the Air Force to pursue a highly specified track and isn't able to do it and then keeps failing downwards. But it's okay because he's blessed to do something big.
But why the idea to cast the real people? What's wrong with actors?
Yeah, it's strange because every time a real actor pops up in a scene, like there's a very random segment where they wander around Venice with a woman who's clearly like a professional actor. There's a jarring clash there of somebody performing and somebody just living.
Uh-huh.
I guess that he's just really merging these worlds of documentary and blockbuster filmmaking so close together. But I will say I fell so under the spell of it in a second, under this very weird, not good spell, that at the end when they're getting, you know, pinned with the Legion of Honor medal, for a moment I thought, oh, here's the archival footage and we're going to see the real people. And then I blinked and said, oh, wait, it's weird to actually see the real people there. But then also their fictional moms played by Judy Greer and Jenna Fisher. It's almost bizarre as a stunt.
Yeah. And so when you say documentary, are they actually interviewing them or they're acting and playing themselves?
They're playing themselves.
Okay, so it's not actually documentary. It's
not, but I think people will treat it as one. You know, and I think they've been treating a lot of his films as them. Soli, American Sniper, they've been treating these films like documentaries, which I think is dangerous ground.
Yeah. Okay, next up, something that is clearly not a documentary. It's a live-action adaptation of Beatrix Potter's classic, Peter Rabbit.
Once upon a time, in a beautiful wood, there lived a rabbit named Peter with a blue jacket.
Sorry!
And no pants.
Come on in! We've got the garden.
Help yourself to anything.
Wait, didn't you try to eat me? Show me your teeth. Do like a goat, like... It was you! I knew it! How are you? So good to see you.
Okay. Whitney, you saw this one, The Rabbit with No Pants.
Here's what you need to know about Peter Rabbit. There is a rendition of almost the entirety of Len's Steal My Sunshine, diegetically performed by CGI sparrows. For people who are fans of Beatrix Potter, you're going to be grievously upset by this movie. Beatrix Potter's originals were very sort of peaceful morality tales, and her illustrations made them feel very pastoral, like you could smell the earth of these woodland creatures. They looked like actual animals. Now they've been reduced to more or less Shrek. They're making pop culture references and they're trashing human houses and singing Steal My Sunshine by Len. It's kind of upsetting to see this very typical kind of hyperactive children's entertainment ethos being applied to something like Peter Rabbit. The story is essentially furry vengeance, if you remember the Brendan Fraser film. Crouchy.
I don't, unfortunately.
Well, consider yourself fortunate, I suppose. But a crotchety old Scottish farmer dies. He's played by Sam Neill. And the animals celebrate. They can break into his garden now and eat all of the vegetables. But an unknown heir, played by Domhnall Gleeson, moves back into the old man's garden and essentially wages war on the woodland creatures. And it's largely a series of Home Alone-style pranks where they try to shoot and electrocute one another.
Hmm.
I'm sure Beatrix Potter would have loved that sort of conceit with Peter Rabbit hooking car batteries up to doorknobs and that sort of thing. James Corden plays Peter Rabbit, and yeah, he's just sort of a very typical, wisecracking, flawed hero to the point where he starts talking about his own character traits in plain terms within the screenplay. There are a few amusing moments, but it's really, really difficult to get past the conceit that this is a movie about CGI rabbits kicking Domhnall Gleeson in the face. Huh. Rose Byrne appears in the movie. She's a delight. Domhnall Gleeson is actually very, very game. You can sort of throw him in a crate with other actors like maybe John Goodman from The Borrowers or Christopher Walken in Mouse Hunt, who are going to give their all into a completely ridiculous movie. So it's nice to see that he's not sleepwalking through this. It's not quite enough to save the film from being just a mild rash.
Yeah.
I've seen much worse, but no.
No. So that's a miss. I will say, when you want to talk about rabbits, you know, on you know, seeking vengeance, Watership Down is a really good movie.
You should see Watership Down.
That is a really good movie.
Yeah. Celebrating its 40th anniversary this year.
Okay, so rent that instead. Last up, last but definitely not least, the final installment of the 50 Shades trilogy, 50 Shades Freed. Dakota Johnson, Jamie Dornan back this time as Mr. and Mrs. Gray.
I bought it for us. I should have asked you first.
I love it. Oh my God. Christian.
This is Giamatteo, the architect.
This location is perfect. I'm going to build you a fabulous house.
please stop speaking to my husband as if I weren't here?
Anna.
You may call me Mrs. Gray.
Okay. Hilarious, Amy, in a good way.
I'll just say up front, I love this franchise so much. With the giant caveat that the books are terrible, but they have made the best possible films out of terrible books that hit all of these completely ridiculous plot points and yet are aware that it's ridiculous. They have this amazing lead performance in Dakota Johnson, who plays a character who gets literally everything she wants. I mean, in this movie, she's married a billionaire at the very start of the film. She's now the editor of a publishing company in its fiction section, where she was an intern in the last film. I mean, this woman should be insufferable, and she plays her with so much knowing good humor that you're rooting for her anyways. Uh-huh.
And what about all the S&M stuff that was in the previous ones?
The S&M is pretty... Well, I mean, it was always sort of caffeine-free diet S&M as is.
Right.
They couldn't really get too far into, like, the really expensive toys. But it's now been reduced to occasional sex acts and painting one another with vanilla ice cream. Mm. So you can tell that, you know, at the start of the series, it was... intended to be a series about a woman sort of opening up and finding her sexuality and in a 9.5 week sort of way, discovering that she has this part of herself that she wants to explore. The second film was very much about how he was taking things too far. And you realize that it was a fantasy about finding the bad boy and taming him. And now he is tamed.
Yeah, the handcuffs belong to her very firmly in this movie. I mean, if there's any thought that the idea of a film where there's a naked woman in handcuffs blindfolded a lot, is it all a bad film for the Me Too movement? I mean, she really is holding the reins here. And after all, this is a franchise that started with them literally negotiating a contract of what clamps were allowed in this relationship. It's a strangely progressive, absolutely insane film starring people that don't exist on Earth.
But strangely progressive, and it sounds kind of traditional. Even when you have, the married life and the woman is in control and that's in the man fields that he's... His wings have been clipped.
It's unbelievably traditional. This is, you know, BDSM for the people who shop in the front of the pleasure chest. They don't go to the back where all the really expensive stuff
is. Well, I want to ask what's in the back, given the tone in your voice, but we're on the radio.
So it sounds like you're into it, Amy. You're not so much into it, Whitney.
It's strangely hilarious because of these weird, mawkish dialogue scenes and the way that it plays itself. You said it was kind of for laughs. That's Dakota Johnson. The film as a whole plays it completely straight.
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think James Foley knows exactly what he's doing. I think he knows exactly the strange garbage book he was given. And I think, I mean, this film is going to get nominated for Razzies, but I think it deserves its own strange Oscar for managing to make something this watchable out of books that are so awful.
The character of Christian Grey has never been not problematic, however. He has been very assertive. He's been very stalkery. He forces things on the Dakota Johnson. Anastasia Steele, excuse me. How could I forget Anastasia Steele? He gives things to Anastasia that she doesn't ask for. He, you know, controls her life and is trying to be very kind of stalkery and keeps tabs on her. And
in the first film, but here, when he tells her not to take off her bikini top, she does. And then when he says, "Why do you defy me?" she says, "Because I can." And the film agrees with that.
Luckily, all of his stalker techniques, like tracking where her phone is and keeping tabs on her location at all times and trying to keep men out of her life, ends up paying off in the climax of this film when a stalker, his name is Jack Hyde. I'm surprised they didn't give him the middle initials LN, Jack LN Hyde, kidnaps her.
However, it's worth pointing out that Jack shows up in the last film as a bad boss who sexually harassed her. So this is a film of the moment.
All right. Sounds like a really great weekend at the movies.
It's a blast.
Amy Nicholson writes for Variety and hosts the podcast The Canon. Whitney Seibold contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, highlights from the Winter Olympics, which began today. Our resident Norwegian will be here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, the excitement of the Olympics finally here. Press Play now has its own kind of borrowed Olympic theme there. The opening ceremony has already begun. It's already happened. It's over in Pyeongchang. But since South Korea is, what, 17 hours ahead of us, we can watch it tonight at around 5 o'clock. Some events have already happened, and a bunch more will be taking place this weekend. Here to update us is our resident Norwegian winter sports fan and Press Play producer Christian Bordahl. Hi.
It's so exciting, Madeline. It's so exciting.
I know.
Getting ready for a long weekend of lying on the couch.
Barely contain all the excitement. So the big news is figure skating, right?
Yes. Last night didn't go so well, I'm afraid.
Bailed on his second quad, missed the triple.
Okay, Nathan Chen, he's the hometown hero, right?
He's the quad king from Long Beach, missed some of his jumps last night. He was not very happy with himself. He kind of underperformed. The team competition, by the way, which is what we're talking about now, it's not the individual, so he still has a chance to win a medal in the individual competition. But this is the team competition, which happened for the first time in Sochi only 4 years ago. You've got men's and women's short programs. There's a pairs program. There's ice dance, and there's men's and women's long program. So there's still time to go on that one.
Okay, good. And then there was a U.S. pairs team that also skated.
Right. They skated last night. That's the husband and wife team of Chris Knierim and Alexa Simika Knierim. They also got fourth place. Despite falling, by the way, we should say that Nathan Chen got fourth place out of 10. They also got fourth place. And between the two of them, that was good enough to be in second place now overall behind Canada, which is good news, except that Japan and Russia are only 1 point behind, and they have really strong individual skaters coming up.
So are you just ruining it for us if we wanted to watch it tonight? This will not be rebroadcast tonight.
No, this was on last night. I will not give any kind of,
good
forward news about any of this stuff.
Okay, so when can we watch the rest of the competition?
So that team competition, you've got women's short program, you've got ice dance short program tomorrow, and then it's all going to come down to the long programs on Sunday.
All right, that's skating. What else should we be watching?
You should definitely be checking out men's downhill. That's live tomorrow at 5 p.m. Saturday, 5 p.m. men's downhill. Those guys are insane. They are, they usually do, like they'll hit like 90 plus miles an hour.
Wow.
Someone invariably wipes out. No one participates in that sport without getting injured sooner or later. They all have bad knees, bad backs. I was watching some practice runs in the last couple of days, and it's a really open field. The Swiss skier called Beat Feutz has been the guy to beat this year, but there's also Oxelund Svindal, who is
That's why
Norwegian.
We have you doing this segment.
Right. He's back from bad injury, skiing really well. His compatriot, Kjetil Jansrud.
Yes.
He's really good, so he could do well. Unfortunately and unusually, there's no real American medal contenders. Bodie Miller, is not skiing anymore. Ted Ligety is back, but he's been badly injured and probably, isn't really a medal contender. So not in the men's downhill, but also happening this weekend is women's giant slalom. That's going to be live on Sunday at 5, and there you're going to get to see the American phenomenon, Michaela Schifrin.
Oh, yeah.
She's one of the favorites in that race. You're going to be hearing a lot about her if you haven't already during these Olympics. She is amazing. She won gold in slalom in Sochi 4 years ago. She was only 18 years old. Since then, she has completely dominated slalom. But she's also now starting to race in some of the speed races. She's definitely good at giant slalom. She even won a downhill race this year. I can't begin to tell you how unusual that is, that someone who is a great slalom skier also wins a downhill race, because they're completely different technically. You're using completely different muscles. You have to do completely different things. She's just incredible. She's only 22. She's won more races than just about any other woman in the history of alpine skiing already. Except for, of course,
Lindsey Vonn,
who is going to be in Super G and downhill and is skiing great right now coming into the Olympics.
Okay, so we can watch them this weekend as well?
We can watch Michaela, not Lindsey Vonn. Okay. She won't be up yet.
All right. And now what about my favorite, the biathlon?
The biathlon, yes. The biathlon is an incredible race.
For those of us who don't know what that is.
Yes. Skiing and shooting.
Okay, yep.
I interviewed an American woman who's going to be a contestant. She's going to be skiing this weekend, Joanne Reed from Palo Alto. So we're going to talk more about biathlon and her next week, but the U.S. has never, ever won an Olympic medal in biathlon.
I'm shocked at that. Yes. It's so popular.
But they do have a real chance this year, primarily through a guy named Lowell Bailey. He's 36 years old already, but he did the unthinkable last year. He won a gold medal at the World Championships in biathlon, so he really is a realistic medal contender in biathlon for the U.S.
Okay. What else?
Let's see. There's so much stuff. It's incredible.
I know,
we talked about ski jumping yesterday. Yep. There's luge this weekend. There's short and long track speed skating. You know, Korea is the powerhouse in short track speed skating, so that is going to be a big ticket, hot ticket item. But there's also this wonderful young black woman who has burst on the scene in short track speed skating. Her name is Mame Biney, and she is incredibly fun to watch. She always just seems to be having a really good time, and she really could do well in short track this weekend. There's also long track, which is one of my personal favorites. The women will be racing 3,000 meters. The men will be racing 5,000 meters.
And why is that one of your favorites?
It's just beautiful to watch, yeah. Like the movements
they
of it.
So it's
just
close
so
and they touch the
lovely.
Ice. They, yeah.
Well, that's short track when they touch the
oh,
ice.
Okay.
Long track, the long kind of gliding, yeah. You know, it's a big oval, 400 meters, just like a regular track.
So they're not touching the ice.
But think about it, 5,000 meters, that's 5 kilometers, right? 3 miles. The world record is 6 minutes for the guys at 5,000 meters. That's an average of just over 30 miles an hour that these guys are skating on that track.
Oh.
They move pretty fast. But that's, you know, by the way, the guys are skating 5,000 meters. The women are skating 3,000 meters. It's one of those stupid things that they do where the women don't get to compete in a distance that's as long as the men. They do this in all kinds of winter sports. They do it in biathlon. They do it in downhill skiing, even that we just talked about. They'll bring the women further down the hill to start. They do it in cross-country skiing.
And yesterday we talked about
ridiculous.
Ski jumping. They only get one event.
They only get one event. It's really, it sucks, and they need to fix that.
Okay, so it sounds like the Winter Olympics are a little behind maybe the Summer Olympics
when
it comes to gender equity.
When it comes to that, absolutely.
All right, can we just agree that cross-country skiing is perhaps the most boring sport to watch?
Madeline Brand, I'm coming to your house this weekend. I'm going to tie you down to your easy chair, and we're going to watch cross-country skiing together.
God.
And you will see it is fantastic. It is so exciting.
What is exciting about it?
Well, first of all, the U.S. has never been very good at cross-country skiing, but this year, in the last couple of years, the U.S. women's team has been really, really good. Jessica Diggins, who I just talked to the other day, is a real medal threat. She's been winning all kinds of races, or at least getting on the podium. She's so much fun to watch. It's really going to be exciting.
You still haven't convinced me that it's exciting, just that we have a chance.
Oh, we do.
Okay,
we do.
We have a chance. All right.
I reached out, by the way, to see if people are going to be planning to watch this weekend. 16% said every minute I can, just like me. 15% said they're excited for at least a few events. 35% said, maybe a bit. And the other 34%, not a snowball's chance in hell. So I'm going to make it my personal mission to improve those numbers, Madeline Brand.
Okay, well, you're going to have to come over to those listeners' houses and tie them to
exactly.
their own chairs. Okay, thank you, Christian Bordahl.
Absolutely.
Press Play senior producer and our resident Norwegian. That's it for Press Play for this week. Our show, directed by Sarah Sweeney, produced by Christian Bordahl, Amy Todd, Gina Pollack, Michelle Alloy, Anna Scott, and Yael Evan Orr. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. Phil Richards engineered today's show. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend watching the Olympics or whatever you're doing. I'll see you on Monday.